No, we're leaving all
routine. Take a trip down to Sister's Sage for a variety of handmade soaps, bath fizzies, smudge sprays, and salves infused with traditional plant medicines. Sister's Sage is an award-winning local indigenous business run by Tsimshian entrepreneur, activist, and community builder Lynn Marie Angus and her dog TJ. Passionate about crafting wellness products that are respectful of the land we live on, Sister's Sage is committed to a heart-centered approach to self-care as well as our collective healing. Located on 1312 Kingsway, you can drop by from Monday to Saturday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. See you there.
Are you interested in radio? Do you want to start your own show but you don't know where to get started? Make your radio dreams come true by joining a collective. From the news collective, the arts collective, the music collective, the sports collective, the accessibility collective, the indigenous collective, and the intersectionality collective, there's something for everyone. And we provide free technical training to get started. Explore these worlds virtually and in person, and be prepared to make fun friends. For more information, visit citr.ca/get involved.
What do you love, and what do you love about it? My name is Ewan, and with I Love You Hour, I want to know. Come join me bi-weekly Tuesdays at 6 p.m. to discuss music and the stories we connect to it, either in person, on the phone, or through messages at I Love You Hour on Instagram. That's ILUVU Hour on Instagram, or through email at iluvhour@gmail.com. If you love sharing music and telling stories, listen to I Love You Hour bi-weekly at CITR 101.9. And remember, I love you.
Hello. Welcome. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to Unceded Airwaves. I'm Danny. I'm Red River Métis Cree. And today, I'm joined in the studio with...
Cooper, also Red River Métis.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
And us Métis folk over here, we... What would the plural of Michif Nia be? Michif Kia? I don't know. But we're sitting here on the unceded, stolen, ancestral territories of the Hunkelmeetum-speaking Musqueam people. We broadcast all the way out to the also stolen, also unceded, also ancestral territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish people in the region that has been colonially labeled as Vancouver. We're at UBC right now, but we broadcast also to the whole world. But on the radio waves, those are the nations that we reach out to. And you just heard a song called All Around You by Zune off of the album Becca Maigen. I think I've got that. So I'm just going to read, I'm going to pull this up, Cooper, too, just from Zune's Wikipedia. Zune is a Canadian shoegaze band from Hamilton, Ontario, whose core member is Anishinaabe musician Daniel Monkman. They are most noted for their 2020 album Bleached Waves, which was a shortlisted finalist for the 2021 Polaris Music Prize.
Originally from Selkirk, Manitoba.
Woo! Homelands.
Manitoba mentioned.
Selkirk mentioned.
Yes, Selkirk. Selkirk mentioned. A member of the Broken Head Ojibwe Nation, Monkman moved to Hamilton after stints living in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Winnipeg mentioned. And Calgary, Alberta. Okay. They abandoned music for a number of years, during which they struggled with drug and alcohol addiction before getting sober with the help of traditional Anishinaabe teachings of the Seven Grandfathers.
Shout out the Seven Grandfathers. Monkman reestablished their musical career in Hamilton, initially using the band name Bloom before adopting the name Zund from the grandfather's teaching of Zungi Dewan, I think. Bravery and Courage, the band, and that is in Anishinaabe Mohan. The band whose music blends shoegaze rock with elements of traditional First Nations music in a style which Monkman refers to as moccasin gaze.
Wow.
That goes so hard. Alternatives everywhere, just like... Whoa. That is like the coolest thing I've ever heard. And I wish Cora, who also works here at CITR and is also native, I wish I could go run and tell her that right now. Oh my goodness, moccasin gaze, are you kidding me? Did they make this for me in a lab? It features a varying lineup, with its current members being Daniel Winterman's, cool last name, bassist Drew Rutt, and drummer Andrew McLeod. Those are just guy names. Daniel, Drew, and Andrew.
Oh yeah. Drew is pretty much Andrew.
Pretty much. They've also collaborated with Adam Sturgeon of Status Non-Status and Amagiji, who we play a lot on this show. Shout out. And before we get back into it and talk to you about magazines, which is what we have on the schedule for today, we'll be talking specifically about Redwire magazine a lot, which is like the coolest thing ever. First ever Native youth-run magazine in Canada for Native youth by Native youth. It went defunct in the late 2000s. But before that, I'm going to play some more alternative music for you guys. I'm going to start with What's the Vibe? What's the Vibes? Tell me what the vibes are. What's the Vibes? By Dem Rose Boys and Jeremy Parkin, who's an Indigenous alternative artist. I'm pretty sure he's Cree. Let me check that. We got to have like some like knock-knock jokes or something for our breaks. We're going to have like Native-themed. He's from Kwanlindun First Nation in Whitehorse, Yukon. I think he's Dene. So yeah, we're going to play that for you. I'm not sure about Dem Rose Boys, but if I find out, I will come back to you with that. And that's a single. And then Astum featuring Leanne Betasamosake Simpson, which is a song by Zune featuring this icon, who if you're familiar with the Turtle Island world, you know this name. I don't even need to say anything. Here's What's the Vibes. No, we're leaving all
What's the vibe? street into the ocean. Holding back our years in the morning.
Storytelling is powerful. Our stories carry personal and collective histories, build bridges of understanding, and shine light on unseen truths. Your story, your voice, your power. CITR and Discorder is excited to announce the release of 5 unique podcasts as a part of its Power and Voice podcast incubation program. Power and Voice is an entry-level educational program created by CITR to surpass traditional barriers to entry into the medium of spoken word radio and podcasting. The result is a series of podcasts demonstrating a wide diversity of work in genre, structure, and content. Tune in every day from April 14th to 18th from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. to hear Power and Voice storytellers share their stories on their own terms and in their own words.
Dansez, mes amis! Dansez. Ta wow. Hello, everybody. Dansez, kia wow. Today, we are talking about magazines and Indigenous publications here on Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9 in so-called Vancouver or CITR.ca, depending on what you're listening on. You just heard... What's the Vibes by Dem Rose Boys and Jeremy Parkin, and then Astum featuring Leanne Betasamosake Simpson by Zune, which is an Indigenous shoegaze band, and that was a single. That was so good. I was not expecting the title and the fact that Dem Rose Boys are on it should have given me the vibe, but Jeremy Parkin does more like ambient alternative stuff, so I was really trying to give you that kind of alternative Indigenous rock music vibe today. But what's the vibes?
What is the vibes?
We found them, I think. So we're going to get into talking about Red Wire Magazine, which is so cool, and I learned about this publication when I was at, I think, Spartacus Books, or Massey, I don't remember, and they had a section of just like old free publications, and there was just a bunch of Red Wires, and as soon as I like cracked one open, I was like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life. Are you kidding me? It's so cool. And just seeing all of these things that are things that I believe in so strongly, and most of these were written before I was even born. Like, I didn't even exist, and they're talking about things that you could post on social media, and you wouldn't even need to change anything. It's the exact same thing happening, and the same way of approaching it and talking about it in the same language, and it's, like, it's kind of sad, honestly, to, like, be like, whoa, this literally could have come out today, and this came out before I was even alive. So let's get into it.
Redwire magazine was created in 1997 by sisters Nina and Billy Pierre with the support of Environmental Youth Alliance and Native Youth Movement. The first ever Native Youth-run magazine in Canada, Redwire documented a talking circle between Native youth artists, writers, activists, and readers across Turtle Island discussing the issues important to our communities. Is it actually, like, all youth writing it?
Yes.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't realize
youth
that.
Being, I think, up to, like, 22, 23.
Okay, yeah.
So it's not, like, just teenagers and stuff.
Wow.
And then for over 10 years, Redwire created a space to critically examine the band council system, the treaty process, the effects of residential school, targeted army recruitment in our communities, something I myself have seen. That's like a whole other thing of like targeting, like Canadian army targeting First Nations people. And corrupt economic greed. It combated the corporate media's portrayal of activists and Native people who fight for their rights. It has given voice to families who have lost loved ones to police violence.
Through the magazine, we have promoted a generation of proud young Native artists, writers, musicians, and performers to an international stage. The quarterly magazine reached a distribution of 11,000 copies across Canada, four times a year before losing its funding in 2002. Before losing its funding. In 2002, Redwire magazine incorporated as Redwire Native Youth Media Society, a collective of Native youth creating uncensored spaces for youth to find their voices. While no longer publishing a magazine, collaborations on smaller print projects targeted those with limited or no access to internet, such as youth in prison and those living in rural areas, and pilots for Redwire TV are under development.
That's pretty old. Unfortunately, okay. I don't think it is. But once we get into reading it, you'll see why the government would take away their funding, because this magazine was literally like creating the most radical, like militant Indigenous youth in communities and literally preparing people to mobilize. Like, I saw one that was literally a how to do a blockade. Like, materials, tactics, who you need, I can see why the government would not want to fund this. I'm really, really sad that they lost their funding, but I think that's kind of awesome that they're doing things so cool that the government was like, this isn't our reconciliation thing. Like, this is too far.
And they weren't willing to just, like, make it shitty.
Yeah, because it's supposed to be uncensored and supposed to be what it is. So we're going to read, I found this online. Let me go to this link. Volume 6, Issue 4 of Redwire Magazine. It's online, available as a PDF. And I was really trying to find, like, an online archive, and there really is no, like, super together good archive of these magazines, which is really unfortunate. But this issue is from, I'm trying to find a date to give you when this one is from. So hold on while I do that. The PDF is loading. But I'm pretty sure this one is from, I think, July 2004, if I'm not mistaken, because when I was looking at it, I was just thinking about how this was just a few months before I was born. But yeah, we'll start off by reading the staff. So the staff at Redwire was Tanya Willard, who you might be familiar with. That's another thing, is a lot of the names in this magazine I recognize from Indigenous studies, just the, like, Indigenous ethos. All things. Joanna Ricalmo, editor, Peter Morin, arts director, Simon Reese, writer.
Sorry, I don't know if I have the PDF link. I was just seeing I see it. Thank you. That's my
bad. Yeah, word. It has a really cool cover as well. The cover of this issue, and yes, it is July 2004, is by Lawrence Paul. Not sure how to say the rest, but he's a very, very known artist. I did a paper writing about his stuff, but this cover is like warping the British Columbia flag, and with Coast Salish form line on the mountains, and it's so cool. So cool.
Oh, wow.
Those mountains with, like, frogs and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
The sun is, like, crab legs. And then the people. Yeah, Lawrence Paul, a big theme of his drawings are business people with, like, Coast Salish form line heads, which are really cool. We'll start with reading that. I'm going to start with reading the editor's note. So, or just the, like, beginning part that you would open on the first page. Redwire Native Youth Media Society is a media and arts organization dedicated to Native youth expression. Redwire incorporated as an independent Aboriginal youth society in November of 2002 under the name Redwire Native Youth Media Society. Redwire magazine published its first issue in April 1997 with the support of the Native Youth Movement, a grassroots Native youth group, and the Environmental Youth Alliance. Redwire, published by Redwire Native Youth Media Society, is the first ever Native youth-run magazine in Canada and continues to stay committed to operating with Native youth staff, writers, artists, and publishers.
Sorry, my PDF is still loading.
That's all good. I've also got the pages that we'll read in the doc itself.
Thank you.
Redwire Native Youth's media mandate is to provide Native youth with an uncensored forum for discussion in order to help youth find their own voice. The opinions and perspectives, oh, that's just their disclaimer. But they were funded through the generous support of Urban Multipurpose Aboriginal Youth Centers, UMAYC, from the Department of Heritage Canada. So I can see why Heritage Canada would cut this. And also of note, something I can't like transmit over the airwaves, but the art is so old internet, like late 90s, early 2000s. So cool. So first, I'm going to read out the features list. So the feature list, page 16, we've got random rants for TV babies. Page 18, psychological decolonization. 23, dig your grave, disco homeboy.
24, decolonize your diet. 26, education and assimilation. 27, an interview with
Taiyake, maybe?
Taiyake, Alfred. Page 31, honoring those gone before us. Page 32, de-school long Cree style.
34 is warrior women. 39, colonization and nation building. 41, three hots and a cot in an 8x12. Water responsibility, page 42, unlearning learning, 45, 10 steps to decolonize, and First Nations support worker. So cool! Like, I love this magazine so much. And then they have, at the beginning of this next page, they have a, and I'm wondering if it's kind of a co-opting of, the Alcatraz takeover, where they had a notice, this is an Indian occupation, I think, or something. But they have a little thing that says, notice, this is an Indian editorial. Any person who trespasses on a... And then it's, like, blurry because you're not meant to read that. But just, it's such a fire image. It's so good. So I think we'll just start here because I want to read these first few pages. I really want to read some of the letter to the editors that people had to say because people would get really, really mad. So I'm going to hop to page 2 where it says, cool it, Redwire. I noticed that some of your writers sound really angry. I wonder why. We're not angry at all. I am a mom, auntie, grandmother, and teacher. I wouldn't allow my children or students to talk the way some of your writers write. They sound like a dumb rap song that needs to...
Oh.
I'm not reading that. They said something extremely racist. That's absolutely wild. To the young, and then it continues, to the young Simon Rees picking on the Cherokees. Don't pick on anybody until you know what you were talking about. I don't mind those people being part Cherokee and saying it. So she's like fighting for the rights of people who claim to be part Cherokee. And then they're just going off about that. Claiming that Prime Minister Trudeau was Native as well. Wow.
Yikes. Wow. This is a crazy letter.
Wow. So this lady is just really mad and thinks that we need to be more polite. She said, I'm writing to you because it embarrasses us to hear young people now. They don't know who they are. Learn your language. We don't have swear words in our language. Whoa. And then here's what they had to respond. Hello, Marie. Would you like to?
Sure. Redwire does not censor any of our writers' submissions or anger or explicit language. This has been one of our philosophies since the birth of Redwire. Anger is a natural response to all the social problems that stem from colonization. And we also feel that anger is a gift, just like the rest of all of our emotions given to us at birth. Many Native youth feel anger, pain, sadness. They chose to express themselves in a lot of different ways. I think we all know about these negative ways to express anger or shame. Suicides, abuse, and substance use, whatever they may be going through at the time in their lives, we provide a safe space for them to express their emotions, and Redwire serves Native youth by not censoring each other.
The Gravel Road Gangstas article, which I guess she's talking about and complaining about, was meant to poke fun and encourage our young people to laugh at themselves. The whole complete article was fake and was produced because so many Native youth are adopting the gangster American hip-hop culture and stabbing and beating each other up on reservations across Canada. We are trying to show them how funny it is to act like something we are not. You might label my humor as satire. Most adults did not get it, and most young people really enjoyed it, but Redwire is not meant for adults. Our focus is to appeal to youth and give them a strong message. The article, They Are All Cherokee. That article must have been heat also. I'm really curious about that. In Redwire Volume 6, Issue 3, was inspired by personal encounters with the writer Simon Rees, who has had with many white people claiming to be Cherokee. Also, a website called NativeCelebs.com, which has a long list of high-profile actors that had questionable Native heritages, was a source for the article. As Indian people, what do we have to gain from movie stars calling themselves Indians? Is it right for white people to call themselves Indians for financial gain? For the new age hippie sitting on a California mountain to teach Indian songs and make a mockery of our spiritual ceremonies? I have much love and respect to the good white people out there. But you don't have to call yourself an Indian to help us out. When it comes to swear words in Indian languages, we definitely know some. Every language has them. Yeah, also, like, I'm thinking of so many swear words in my language. Like,
well, what was the story about the...
the one my brother told you?
Yeah.
I won't tell the whole story, yeah. But my brother, like, had like a like story circle almost after an unseated event telling this story from that we learned in Mitchiff class. When Coco Marie taught us a swear word. But we most definitely have swear words.
Also, if she was starting to read Gravel Road Gangsters, like if she read that title, continued, and then wrote that letter, like I fear from the title alone you should have known it maybe isn't for you.
Yeah, literally. Like for her to complain that it's not like well articulated and it's...
They were not submitting it to her English class.
This is Redwire magazine, ma'am. So there's that, which is so interesting to hear. I just saw another one. Oh my god, this is so good. Wait, go back to page one to the very end.
Oh, okay.
This is the first letter to the editor. This is so fire. I can't wait to read this. It is time to stand up and take back what is rightfully ours. And again, for anyone who's just tuning in, we are reading Volume 6, Issue 4 of Redwire Magazine, which was an Indigenous youth magazine based out of BC and went defunct in the late 2000s. This issue is from July 2004, and we're reading Letters to the Editor. Dear brothers and sisters, I may happen to be 43-year-old. I don't care if your mag is just for the youth. I happen to still be a youth at the at symbol, heart, mind, and spirit. That's why I had to join up with your website. What you have to say in it, all caps, rock on, bloods. I happen to be a very left-wing capital A advocate, capital A activist. In other words, all caps, it's time to stand up and take back what is rightfully ours. This is how I feel after reading Redwire. I love the picture of you three in a lineup, and in the picture it says, guilty party. One time two cops asked me if I had broken any laws. I said yes. The cop said, what? I said, being born a two-spirit Métis, us. literally me. But when I went to the Aboriginal Fest this year, I was proud to be one. Thanks, Redwire! Although I happen to be a white Métis, because of the story about Barbie dolls, beads, and blankets, tears of joy and great pride are running down my cheeks. I love your new editor. I happen to be half Viking and Haida myself. We are the ones who you will never take shit from. No one. You guys have healed the infected wound in me. All caps. All my relations. Black Thunder Eagle, Two Spirit. Ho!
That was actually you.
I need to send off my emails with all my relations.
All caps.
Thoughts on this?
I like that. Like, no context. One time two cops asked me if I'd broken any laws. I said yes. The cops said what? I said being born two-spirit Métis.
Like, that goes so hard. Yeah, that's like, so cold.
The train of thought here feels like a story from my grandma.
The cops said what? I said being born a two-spirit Métis.
Yeah, and then I'm like, Grandma, when did that happen?
That's so... This is just so good. I want to do a whole episode just reading letters to the editor. And I love that this person just felt so pumped. Like, oh, they read that last issue, and they... I don't know if they typed this or hand wrote this, but... All my relations. Oh. That's amazing. Next, I think we will move on to... There's just a bunch of reviews and a lot of really, really cool stuff. But I found this one article. I'm going to go back to the doc for this. And it is an article by Tara Willard. Hold on, I'm pretty sure I know who this is. Yes, okay, yeah, she's around UBC. She did her degree here, where we are literally right now. And yeah, I've definitely have done readings of her stuff. I did a whole final project, that she was involved in. It was for an art history class, and she was, a collaborator on the piece that I wrote about. And she's Suquamish, I'm pretty sure. Shout out, Northern Interior BC. And this article is called Warrior Women, The Takeover of Department of Indian Affairs Offices, Vancouver, July 1981. What?! So a bunch of Native women took over the Department of Indian Affairs offices in Vancouver in July of 1981. If you're as gagged by this, you're going to get the whole story if you keep listening. Do you want to read that quote? So in the center of the article, so it's a picture, super fire, and it's a few women like coming out of the doors super happy, and then Warrior Women, the takeover of the Department of Indian Affairs offices, Vancouver, July 1981. And then there's this quote underneath.
From the depths of women's souls comes the power to unite and create change. The watchful moon has seen their courage hold fast over many seasons. The warrior hearts of women will forever charge forward with a force of such power that we will take notice, survive, and thrive. Dana Tiger.
Muskegee.
Thank you.
Creek Nation. Shout. That's so fire.
Yeah.
The watchful moon. Yeah. That's literally, I am a girl in the way that the moon is a girl.
The watchful moon.
Okay, so this article is by Tara Willard, so we're gonna read this for you.
Many of us remember the early 80s as a time of political actions, assertion of rights and title, nationhood and cultural identity. It was during this time that major events that shape our world and history today took place. The Constitution Express to Ottawa, the Indian Child Caravan, and the women's occupation of the Department of Indian Affairs, among others. While many of us have read accounts of politics during this time from a leadership point of view, the history of our male chiefs and leaders, it is the women and their actions that are highlighted, that are to be highlighted here. The lessons that our female relatives learned, and the lessons that our younger generation, the lessons that our female relatives learned, and the lessons that our younger generation can take from this time are here, in the stories of our women. Each and every warrior woman who took part in actions and demonstrations during this time has a story to tell and passes this knowledge on through the work she continues to do in life.
This is only one account of the 1981 women's occupation of the DIA, Department of Indian Affairs, we'll just call it DIA, offices in Vancouver. From research, Indian Affairs has existed since the very beginning of colonization of Canada, we're still governed by them. Like, this goes back to, like, John A. McDonald time, the Department of Indian Affairs, and they enforce the Indian Act. From research conducted through personal interviews, oral history over many years, literature research, and archival research, there are many more stories, perspectives, and layers of history that are out there. Ask one of your female relatives if she remembers that time. Maybe she was there. Maybe you were there. Maybe we were all there. Let me take you there through these words. That's hard. Gathering strength.
It was during the summer of 81 that a group of grassroots women decided to take matters into their own hands. Their concerns were of the poor housing, education, employment, and health on reserves across this province and around the rest of Indian country. These mothers, grandmothers, aunties, and young women gathered their strength at various locations and put their concerns into action in Vancouver at the central offices of the Department of Indian Affairs, DIA. Quote, There was a public outcry in Alberta after a young man, Nelson Smalllegs Jr., committed suicide and left a note condemning the DIA and its treatment of natives. Instead of looking into the matter, Walchley was transferred to British Columbia.
One member of the Concerned Aboriginal Women, CAW, Joyce Willard, remembers gathering around a campfire one evening in Spence's Bridge. Many of the men and political leaders were in Ottawa at this time. She describes the women talking about their serious... This is so fire. Oh, my God. She describes the women talking about their serious concerns about the government policies and the basic needs of Indian people. Concerns about health, housing, education, childcare, culture, human rights, patriarchy, and injustice guided the action.
Of particular concern was the new regional director of the DIA, Fred Walchley. Previously, he was head of the DIA in Alberta, and there was much controversy over his management. There was a small outcry in Alberta after a young man, Nelson Smalllegs Jr., committed suicide and left a note condemning the DIA and its treatment of natives. Instead of looking into the matter, they just transferred Walchley to British Columbia. Jeannie Manuel remembers the beginnings of this occupation at the central DIA office from the age of 12 years. I'm going to Jeannie, okay. Jeannie remembers being at a powwow and waiting for her parents to go back to,
Nisqually
Chase. After waiting a long time, Jeannie found a large group of people, mostly women, talking very seriously. Soon after, the family was off to Vancouver. After driving all evening, they made it to the Union of BC Indian Chiefs offices, where another gathering meeting took place.
Also of note here is that the UBCIC has been historically very patriarchal and is almost like a symbolic entity. Not symbolic, they do a lot of work, like policy work, but I don't know, at least for me, like how I view them, it's very patriarchal, so that's like significant.
Okay, that's good to know.
I guess she's all dudes mostly.
yeah I don't know so much of the context from just from the being from the prairies, but the next morning, the Concerned Aboriginal Women CAW would take over and occupy the general DIA offices in Vancouver.
Occupy, support, and regroup. This is so hard, you guys. Do not keep your finger off of that dial. You need to hear about this. Again, you are listening to Unceded Airwaves on CITR 101.9. We're reading Red Wire Magazine, Indigenous Youth Magazine, an issue from 2004 where they are covering, where Tara Willard is covering the Native women's occupation of the Department of Indian Affairs offices in Vancouver. The first two women to enter the 15th floor of the Toronto Dominion Building, DIA, were an elder and her granddaughter, Marceline and Jeannie Manuel. Approximately 20 women took over the offices on July 20th, 1981. During the seven following days, more women joined and more people wrote to offer their support for the women's action at DIA. Many women from Nisqually, Mount Currie, Bella Coola, and other communities and nations from across so-called BC were part of the action. Equally important was the support that they received from the men. Throughout the occupation, several men acted as security for the women.
Many of the men at home were equally supportive of their female relatives who were taking a stand against injustice. As more and more women joined the occupation, a spokesperson was chosen, Terry John Nee Williams from Mount Currie. Terry would address all media and read out lists of demands and daily press releases. A youth spokesperson was also chosen, Jeannie Manuel from Nisconleth. Is that? Yeah. Okay. The numbers grew and there was no shortage of food or support from outside. Their strength continued to grow and multiply.
List of demands. The main concern that prompted action by the grassroots women was the mismanagement of controversy. Sorry, my brother is texting me about his Barbie Métis outfit that he wore to his friend's wedding in Portland. It's fire. It is fire. Just said Barbie Métis needs to be real stoic. Anyways.
Whoa.
That's good. The list of demands. The main concern that prompted action by the grassroots women was the mismanagement and controversy surrounding Regional Director General Fred Waltzley. The group was calling for the resignation of Waltzley from his position at the DIA due to his divide and conquer tactics in dispersing federal funding to Indian communities. It's so jarring seeing these things that were taught in elementary school and stuff to associate as Canada's past as very much its present. Like, when I hear, like, Indian affairs and then something about, like, Dominion and about, like, what did it say? Divide and conquer. And, like, that all to me feels like social studies curriculum of things that were way back. So it's so nuts to me that there's just a guy who's doing the exact same thing in this time. And there's still, like, there's a head of Indian affairs right now, as there was in, like, 1800-something. The women said that Waltzley favored bands that assimilated into white society and withheld money from bands that were autonomous. This sounds like Edgar Dewdney. The entire bureaucracy of the DIA was not helping Native communities, and the women were fed up. One elder said during a CBC-taped interview, "If this is the Department of Indian Affairs, then where's all the Indians? There should be Indians in these positions." Facts.
Snaps for that. Another demand was for an independent inquiry into the operations of the department's BC office, as well as a meeting with Indian Affairs Minister John Monroe to discuss grievances. Although Monroe was willing to meet with the women on July 22nd, it was on the condition that women leave the occupation and vacate the premises immediately after and send a delegation to Ottawa. These women refused this offer and continued their occupation.
For 6 hours, the concerned Aboriginal women and that's like an acronym, like CAW, not just concerned Aboriginal women, the concerned Aboriginal women and their male supporters spoke using a talking stick that was rescued from one of the DIA offices and put to its proper use. I love that terminology. Like, this is something you can only find in a magazine by and for Indigenous people. Literally saying that this talking stick was rescued from the Indian Affairs office, because it was totally rescued if it was in there.
Yeah, it probably wasn't being used.
Yeah. So that's like that kind of language, like rescuing. Like, you wouldn't see that in a non-Native publication, because that's truly what it is. Like, it's saving something because it is a living thing with spirit. Anyways. Yeah. Grievances.
One of the most powerful times during... did you just read that?
No, I didn't. Go ahead.
During the occupation came on the seventh day when a group of over 100 women, children, and men met with Senator Ray Perrault to give evidence that supported their demands. For 6 hours, the concerned Aboriginal women and their male supporters spoke using a talking stick that was rescued from one of the DIA offices and put to its proper use. Impassioned speeches spoke of poor housing conditions that often led to accidents and fires. Women talked about the high unemployment rates on reserves, the high alcoholism and suicide rates, and other poverty conditions that affect communities. Others spoke about land and title issues, where governments were extracting gas, oil, and other natural resources from traditional lands, but no royalties or money was being dispersed to Native communities.
Women spoke about forced sterilization of Indian women and the racism and patriarchy involved in the child welfare system when it came to Indian children being apprehended by the government. All of the evidence was heard and recorded by Senator Peralt that evening with a promise that he would take the transcript. Let's see where this goes. the promise that he would take the transcript back to Ottawa to be heard by the minister. He did not really have the authority to meet any of the demands or do anything to move matters forward. Again, Peralt suggested that the women send a delegation to Ottawa to meet with Minister Munro. However, once... Again, this is an agency that's meant to serve us.
Yeah.
Not the other way around.
And they have to stop the entire occupation just to talk to somebody.
Yeah. And this also is, like, making me think of Red River and all the times, like, just come to Ottawa. Like, all the times in Canadian political history where there have been big protests and they're like, well, if you send someone in a nice outfit to Ottawa, you might get a little something.
If you give them a gift first.
It's always, just this exact story of, like, just send some people to Ottawa to meet and we can do something about it in a country that is so massive. And it's so expensive to travel there. Like, yeah. It's so fascinating. It makes me think of Scrip and how so many people, nobody could make it actually to Ottawa. It's wild. However, once again, the women refused. They stood strong in their demands and remained steadfast in the occupation of the regional offices.
Battering rams and police.
I'm not sure what we're going to get into, but I will give a trigger warning just in case. Content warning of police violence against Indigenous people.
A Supreme Court injunction was issued on the fourth day, July 23rd, and the concerned Aboriginal women remained. Negotiations proceeded, and support swelled from about 20 women to over 100, with written support from across the country. After meeting with Peralt, and citing evidence to support demands, the women continued their occupation. Realizing that Peralt had no authority to make anything happen, the next day, police used battering rams to break into the 15th floor office building where CAW and supporters were gathered. 53 people, 42 women and 11 men were arrested, charged with mischief,
and put into jail.
Thank you.
The occupation was peaceful and there was no resistance to the arrests. However, treatment by police was not gentle. One elder who was arrested had her hip put out of place. That's a spiritual crime on your family. That is a curse. Like, you're getting a spiritual curse on behalf of all of us. After the forcible removal by police and a night in jail, the women were released on their own recognizance with the condition to not return to the offices at 700 West Georgia Street.
Lessons, experiences, perspectives. Each woman who took part in the 1981 occupation has a story to tell. Many young women at the time remember that these were the places that they learned about our history and the politics of the present. One young woman who attended the women's occupation and other demonstrations tells her stories about the leaders that she looked up to and how she learned about the culture, history, and rights of Indian people. For her and other young ones, these gatherings were part of an education not offered in the school system. Still not.
Yeah.
These are other ways of learning our history and herstory, rather than textbooks that have very little to offer from an Indian perspective.
Another woman, Diane Anthony, spoke out about what she learned during the occupation. Respect, work, speaking out, and standing up for your rights. Although there was a main spokesperson who addressed the media, many of the women had an opportunity to express their concerns during meetings with the government. When the old talking stick was taken off the wall and used during that's so metal, imagining like wiping the dust off and using it, that's so powerful. Joyce Willard explains that the strength and support of the ancestors she was with her when she spoke. She says, it was like they had lifted me up when I spoke.
Terry John Nee Williams was the spokesperson for the concerned Aboriginal women during the occupation. She is still active in the political arena and expresses her views that, quote, the time for women to stand up and be heard is here again, end quote. She is active in working on issues of Aboriginal rights and title and the 2010 Olympics with their traditional
Statlium territory.
Terry relates the recent cuts to Aboriginal and women's services affecting the basic needs for women and their families as making life for Aboriginal people as bad as the situation that preceded the occupation.
These brave women took a stand so that youth today...
occupation in 1981.
In 1981. The main issues that the CAW were fighting for then are the same now. And this is 20 years later. I'm a woman now. In the time since this was written, I was born 2 months later, and I have grown into a woman to talk about this. And this is all still exactly the same. The rate of Native children in care is still too high, and Aboriginal women and communities still have difficulty meeting basic needs. The occupation of DIA offices in the summer of 81 wasn't planned. It was the culmination of what was happening at the time, and women taking a stand and saying enough is enough. The occupation was a multi-generational action, with many of the women joining their grandmothers and children. That's so powerful. The occupation was a women-led action, which Terry Fields was important for the time because it was the women, especially, who were dealing with the hard times in the homes and the families who were suffering. There was, however, a lot of support from men, and this was equally important.
These brave women took a stand so that the youth today would know who they are and stand up for their rights. Native people have been fighting for their rights for many generations, but the fight is not over. Like their aunties, mothers, and grandmothers before them, the youth must speak up and stand up for the land, because Aboriginal rights and title are still under attack through resource exploitation and development. Our families are still broken up. Too many people live in poverty and don't have their basic needs met.
When the women suffer, the whole community suffers. During the occupation, there were many women elders, and they were just as fed up as younger women. And those younger women now are like the ages of our moms, and we're the next generation. This is still the same. They were demanding that something be done, and the children not be taken away anymore. The women's actions in 81 showed the strength of women when they gathered to support each other.
Into the future. As many of the women indicate through oral history and their life teachings, the struggle is not over. Many of the same conditions are still perpetuated on reserves, and the need to stand up for rights, title, and land, and the underlying issues that affect all other areas is just as significant today. The Peace and Dignity Run 2004 just came through the Vancouver area, and their prayers this year are for Mother Earth and the life givers, the women, the female aspect of creation. It is time for women to gather their strength again and take their rightful place in the circle. Our grannies, aunties, mothers, female relatives who stand up to further the healing in our communities are to be remembered and honored for the work that they do.
Some of these women are still active in the political field. We know we're recognizing these names, and we were both born after this came out, so these women are very much still involved. Hope the same for us. I hope we'll get some change, but I imagine we'll probably also be still doing this. Many work in other areas, childcare, education, health, women, and violence, etc. Others do their work in unseen ways. They are the spiritual advisors and traditional people who Sundance, sweat, pray, and ceremony to bring healing and use their experiences to reflect and teach the younger generations. We are all warrior women in our hearts. And that's by Tara Willard in Redwire, Volume 6, Issue 4, July 2004. And that's perfect timing, because that's all the time we got. Thoughts?
Yeah, it's just the same.
We're literally that could have been today.
This could have been written yesterday.
I hope that someone out there, I hope you learned about the 1981 occupation with us, because I learned as we were reading, and yeah. I'm never going to shut up about that. I'm going to make sure everyone around me in my immediate circle knows that that happened. And I'm curious, because I wonder what my mom knows about this, because she was in Vancouver around that time. But that is the white side of my family, so I don't know.
Actually, my grandma was hopping around a bit, so she might
You should totally ask your grandma.
Yeah,
your grandma would actually send her this. She'll probably have some thoughts. She probably was there.
She's like, I haven't told you about that.
I was actually in there.